Welcome to the Divided Kingdom. This is Elizabeth Caverly.
And this is Lou Caverly. Let's pray together. Oh, Lord, we pray that you would have us say the things that you want us to say today to instruct your people and to warn them. Guide us to say everything that you want us to say in the way you want us to say it, and make those who hear us receptive to your words. We just pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you, Lou. There's a bombshell, of course. We are going to get into what it means with the deadly subway incident in Washington, D.C. There's a lot more here going on than one might think. And I promised in our last meeting together, listeners, that I would finish the story of Nancy Wrightball, the Ebola survivor, and we will do that. There's quite a contrast here, Lou, between good and evil today, isn't there?
Yes, there's a vast difference, a vast contrast. And we'll try that bring that out to those listening.
AP, Washington. The subway train had just pulled out from a busy Washington station when it ground to a halt and foul-smelling smoke began filling the tunnel and the cars. "We're going to die here," passengers cried. In the fear and chaos that followed, riders prayed, but also helped one another, performing mouth-to-mouth on an unconscious woman and offering an inhaler to a man curled in a fetal position on the train's floor. Some waited for rescuers as instructed. Others opened the doors of the train and made their way to safety through the darkness on their own.
One woman died, and more than 80 other people were sent to the hospital, mostly for smoke inhalation, after the electrical malfunction Monday on Washington's Metro. A day later, 21 passengers remained hospitalized, and the accident has left a multitude of unanswered questions. Commuters demanded to know, was the train's evacuation unnecessarily delayed? Were passengers given the right information? And what caused the death of the woman? Authorities in the nation's capital had no immediate answers. The woman, identified Tuesday as 61-year-old Carol Glover of Alexandria, Virginia, was the first fatality on Washington's metro system since a 2009 crash, killed 8 passengers and a train operator. Glover was an analyst for DKW Communications, an IT company that does work for the government and was working on a contract with the U.S. Department of Agriculture at the time of her death, said her supervisor, Cliff Andrews.
The malfunction happened at L'Enfant Plaza, one of the subway's busiest stations, around 3:30 p.m. Monday, at the beginning of the afternoon rush hour. The stop is near the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum and many federal office buildings, including the headquarters of the National Transportation Safety Board, which is leading the investigation. NTSB investigator Michael Flanagan said the smoke started when something came into contact with the high-voltage third rail and caused an electrical arc. The 6-car train stopped about 800 feet beyond the platform, and the arcing occurred roughly 1,000 feet beyond the train, Flanagan said. There was no fire.
Patty Oliventi, 49, was waiting for a train when she heard shouting and saw gray smoke filling the station. She said riders were told to get out, but a bottleneck developed when employees didn't just open the fare gates to make it easier for people to leave. Aboard the subway, passenger Jonathan Rogers, 31, said he and two other people tried in vain for 20 minutes to revive a middle-aged woman who had slumped to the floor unconscious near the front of the train where the smoke was the heaviest. Quote, "We know you do chest compressions and mouth-to-mouth, so that's what we did," Rogers said. "Nothing was happening, and she was laying there unconscious. Somebody took her pulse and said they couldn't feel a pulse." Rogers said a man scooped the woman up in his arms and carried her through the cars toward the back of the train. It wasn't immediately clear if the woman was the one who died. Rogers said he doesn't understand why passengers weren't allowed to leave the train sooner, for the 1 or 2 minute walk back to the platform. Quote, it just kind of felt like why we were trapped on that train that long, Rogers said. All we did was sit there and wait. 40 minutes seems like a long time.
Andrew Litwin, 21, a University of Texas student visiting the Washington area, said about 30 minutes into the ordeal, a fellow rider reached 911 on a cell phone, 911, that is. Litwin, perhaps that was a Freudian slip, Litwin said the news that firefighters were aware of the problem, and they calmed passengers who had been yelling, "We're going to die here." Lewis Clemens, 47, a National Public Radio editor, said he was among a group of passengers who got off the train and walked back to the platform through the pitch-black tunnel, despite instructions to stay on board. Now, I'd interject here, Lou, when you read, you know, they wondered, why were we trapped on that train so long or that long? We think back to 9/11, the real 9/11. Remember how those people were told the big, whatever it would have been, the technology at that time, the loudspeaker, told them to remain in the building. And we've always wondered, is that the population control factor hooking in? They want more deaths. They want more publicity to get the Patriot Act. The more who died, the better. It's really a disgusting, horrible, atrocious, sinister, macabre thing, isn't it? So here we have this same thing. They were told to sit and wait. But Lewis Clemens, 47, this NPR editor, now I hope this is a symbol for all of you who are listening out there. We're bringing you this program as a warning. We had no idea we would be talking about this today. We were going to be talking about torture. The snow came, the ice came. Lou couldn't go to work. Now, had I been here myself today, with all that ice, I probably wouldn't have ventured out to get the newspaper. But because Lou was here, he got the newspaper. So he ran a few errands. He isn't afraid to drive on ice later. So I was looking at the paper, and here it was. And I went to prayer, and I believe that the Lord showed me very definite scriptures that this day of snow and ice, one part of why this happened was so Lou could bring this news to all of you so that we both could. Now, we're not having delusions of grandeur. Almighty God has billions of people on this earth. He has billions of plans for their lives. However, this one aspect was crucial because you are all listening. You know about the New World Order, and you know the dangers that lie ahead if America does not repent. We know that we're in a pre-judgment state, and it's very vital. Each of you, your lives, we get some letters from all of you. We get a little help from you financially. And more than that, several times because of the radio work, when we were at a desperate point this last summer in 2014, and just recently, it's really astounding that a listener would send maybe $20. Actually, this last week, Lou needed $25 for a medical need for me, some medicine. I have a bad tooth, and perhaps it's just a gum problem. We're not sure yet. But because we had been doing the radio work and paying and some other bills, we really were down to no cash. And here came the $20, and we only needed to put $25 to it. Now, is that an accident? I think not. We're in kind of a symbiotic relationship, aren't we? You know, we're struggling to bring you the truth as God guides us. And we are warning you that we can't become complacent. We were a little complacent here over Christmas. We sat back and we think that there is a reprieve by the Lord. But today he very clearly showed me in the scripture this was very important. And it was very important to bring up the background of the New World Order. What is behind this and what their ultimate plan is for all of us patriots and Christians and perhaps Bible-believing Jews. And again, we're going to have to say we're going to bring back some very important information from Al Cuppet. And, of course, Al believes that when the New World Order comes into total fruition, not only Christians will be rounded up, but what he calls theocratic Jews. Now, that would not mean the secular Illuminati-type Jew. No, Al himself told us about Edgar Bronfman, while he was still living, had some kind of a big facility located only a few miles from Al Cuppett's home. And this was supposedly, I believe, to slaughter buffalo. But Al said several women, middle-aged women, you know, who they can't be fooled, they've seen a lot in their lifetimes, they said, this doesn't look right for people, or for buffalo. They said it isn't the right height. So, you know, the entrance to this thing was very suspect. Now that Bronfman has passed on, I think this facility is gone. But we certainly do know that there are some Illuminati-type Jews, as there are other Illuminati people from other nations. But I think it's very important that I'd like to refer to a lecture that was replayed on True News by Rick Wiles a couple weeks ago, J.R. Church. And he said it was a classic interview. And this man's erudition, his learning, was just amazing. And he had looked into that idea, that heretical idea of the Merovingians. And if you don't know about that, it's a lot of the royal families in Europe believe that they were descended from the children of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. So this is what they call the Merovingian dynasty that comes on down in their mind. And he said that this largely, these royal heads in Europe, came from the tribe of Dan. And he illustrated, very interestingly, places in the Bible that seem to show that the Antichrist would come from that seed, from the seed of Dan somewhere. Now, what we're told in a lot of disinfo is that all Jews are evil and we're to hate all Jews. But that doesn't really add up. And there's someone who is publicizing right now a book that tells about the German people and how they supposedly suffered terrible agonies at the end of World War II, you know, after the death camps were opened and so forth and so on. And I have no doubt that some atrocities were committed, some brutality. But the whole thing looks terribly exaggerated and distorted. And Lou is a great student of the Hitler years. He thinks so. Now, interestingly, on the accompanying information that came out from that radio commentator, there were things that looked like calendars that sort of promoted the love of the German people. And I point out I'm largely German in my ancestry, both through my mother and through my father. So anyway, these things that were part of this information in publicizing this new book about post-Hitler Germany and what the West did to it, supposedly, these calendars depicted things like, oh, the cultural beauty of a scene in Germany. But one of them caught my attention rapidly because I felt this was really evil propaganda. There it was. The men of the Waffen SS. And it pictured several of them. Now, if you're caught up in this kind of thing, and you're being tricked to hate Jews, maybe some of these radio commentators are secret Nazis. Did you ever think about that? Did you ever think that they might be working for the New World Order? Because when you really think about who our enemy is, think of Operation Paperclip. Think of all the Nazis who were brought over here. Think of the things that continued with MK-Ultra mind control. It's not logical that the Jews have the international conspiracy. It never has been because they've lost millions and millions of people. That doesn't mean that we haven't had Deborah Tavares on our program talking about Rothschild owning Pacific Gas and Electric. As I said before, there probably are some high-ranking Illuminati Jews. But please, let's get our hearts right, and let's think about maybe why Al Cuppett thinks he should be helping the ordinary theocratic Jews. Remember, Madame Blavatsky, in her writings, and she channeled spiritual masters, there were always two groups that had to be destroyed. Yes, they were Christians and Jews. So think about this as you hear everything that's going on, and don't be tricked into hatred of anyone. Don't have generalized hatred for the police either. we saw here in Maryland around Christmas. There was a special program for children, Shop with the Cops. There were other things. There was a group of policemen helping a little boy with cancer. So, you know, we cannot generalize. Individuals are individuals, and we each choose what we will be. There are some good police, and there are some terrible, brutal thugs. But there are people like that in any aspect of society, not just police. Now, we're getting back to this. Andrew Litwin, 21, a University of Texas student visiting the Washington area, said about 30 minutes into the ordeal, a fellow rider reached 911 on a cell phone, and he said the news that firefighters were aware of the problem calmed passengers who had been yelling, "We're going to die here." Then we mentioned Lewis Clemens, the NPR editor. Now, he was among this group, listeners, of passengers who got off the train and walked back to the platform through the pitch-black tunnel. I think we're all in a pitch-black tunnel of darkness now, and most of the people around you don't want to know, don't care. What do you think, Lou?
Yes, I'm afraid for many, many people, ignorance is bliss. They'd rather know nothing than have to go out of their way to take some action. They just prefer to just be apathetic and ignorant.
And they're going to keep listening to Glenn Beck and CNN forever. Well, here we are with Lewis Clemens saying, "We were not given any information that police or fire were en route or nearby." He said, "All we got was stay in place." Yes, I know there's smoke. Don't leave. And that doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you're sitting there watching over some period, watching the subway cars fill up with smoke. What are you going to be out there? Are you going to be lemmings? Now, I think it is time, when you can, to talk to your neighbors, to talk to your friends. But Lou and I were talking today that this whole terrible outcome, the denouement or the climax of all this, might not come even in our lifetime because, as Al Cuppett points out, there has to be a confiscation of guns before something really, really bad can happen, I think, on a wide scale. That hasn't happened. That's one blessing that God brought through the Obama years. People were so mistrustful that they went out and bought more and more and more guns. It didn't matter what kind of a play was put on there at Sandy Hook. We've heard Wolfgang Albig tell about all the things that we've heard Alex Jones. I think there may have been even some pictures of some people from somewhere else, Bulgaria or somewhere, used to get those pictures of those children. Alex Jones says he feels it was an act. We're not going to say one way or another, but there are a lot of questions that suggest it certainly wasn't the way the mainstream media portrayed it. Now, it's very important that this urban rumor gets out that things are not the way they seem to be. Up there at Flight 93, the memorial, we know that a relative of mine heard an eyewitness tell her in the last year that he saw the shoot down. Another person up there, or several who were in Vietnam, said they knew a missile when they heard it. Okay, now, are you going to be awake? Are you going to do something? You may not be able to do something widely, but first of all, you need to submit your life to Jesus Christ if you're a Christian listening, and really try to get the sin out of your heart. If there's any kind of a hatred toward police, toward Jews, ask the Lord to help you be clear of fanaticism. See, that's the one thing that Lou and I feel we cannot ever tolerate, because this is really going against Jesus, isn't it, Lou?
Yes, you won't find Jesus doing the kind of things that these fanatics say or advocating that to anyone. Jesus made many statements, but he never said to attack anyone. He never said to gather weapons to shoot people. You will never find that anywhere in the Bible in the New Testament, not once.
The only thing he did do is to tell his disciples to sell their cloak for a sword to protect themselves, but there was no vengeance. When Brian McLaren of the Emerging Church, dishonorable fame, says that Jesus was a jihadi, that's just about as bad in my book as some of the Islamic people getting ready to advocate cutting off the heads of people who are Christians. Back to this story, at a news conference Tuesday, Mayor Muriel Bowser declined to give details on how quickly the fire department responded, beyond saying that firefighters got to the scene in their customary time frame. City officials also declined to make the fire chief or the head of the city's 9/11 center available to answer questions. Bowser said her administration is reviewing the response and will release its findings next week. We will find out what happened, get to the bottom of what happened, and commit to fixing it, said Bowser, who took office a week and a half ago. Metro Board Chairman Tom Downs apologized to riders injured, frightened, or inconvenienced. He said the investigation, quote, will be a thorough process that often takes time. Something like the Warren Commission, or something like the 9/11 hearings, Lou?
Well, that could be, and they certainly took their time for both of those, and they certainly managed to whitewash things pretty well in both cases. And if you want to get the truth, maybe you can find some of it. At least in the Warren Commission, they were kind enough, if you can call it that, to publish the hearings and exhibits, and you can find a great deal of the real truth in those. And that is provided you go to the library. I guess a lot of it, fortunately, is online now, so you can get the truth if you're willing to sort through the vast array of mush that's along with it.
Now, we think you're uncommon people who are listening to programs like ours. You know, when we try to advocate to some other people we know, they end up saying, oh, no, that's our night to watch a mystery TV program together. They sense that there's something that's going to challenge their view of reality, and they just can't do that. They really want their easy life, their beautiful home, their wonderful cars. This is what they want. But Lou and I know something else. Through those tough years, not just tough, horrendous years, some of which included my Lyme disease, Lou was there living with me, too. Lou was suffering. Through his 7 years of joblessness during, a time in which he was being tested because an injustice had been done to him by someone. He's a master teacher. You know, just lately, a student came up 100 points on his SAT after Lou's help, and that mother, the grandmother, is a Christian, and she said, I know this was the Lord who helped us find you. Now, this is what we're saying. Some of you may be out there in very tough times. You don't have money. You don't have health. You're getting older. Do not lose hope, because Jesus is there with you. He really is at every moment. And you just plead with him, and you tell him you love him, and you ask him what you can do for him every day with everyone you meet. And you will be surprised. Now, getting back to this whole thing about this investigation, they give background here in this article about the Metro Rail system, and I don't think that's too crucial there. But on Tuesday, Devin Crotman, a rider getting off at the L'Enfant station, said, I don't think there's a lot of trust in how Metro handled this situation. Now, before we go to why we shouldn't have a whole lot of trust in what's going on in America, Lou's going to bring you some still very cutting-edge important information from the book America Sold Out by Ray Hope and Al Cuppet. But before we do that, I promised in our last program to give you the second part of Nancy Wright-Bull's story as found in Woman's Day for February. And I think this is important to realize that here is a woman who stared down the deep face of evil as Satan tried to destroy her with Ebola. And she was someone who had been married for 40 years, and she tells that her husband David and she, about 16 years ago, once their two sons were nearly college age, he left his job at a software company and she left hers at a high school, and they went as missionaries. And they had been in Ecuador for 5 years and Zambia for 8. They helped widows and orphans. And then in the fall of 2013, when they were both 58 years old, they moved to Monrovia, the capital of Liberia, and they were working with SIM, Sudan Interior Mission. And she was supposed to be the personnel coordinator. So in March of 2014, suddenly the Ebola outbreak occurred, and on this program, we've presented an article that really was an iconoclastic article questioning whether the Red Cross, you look into its origins, Rosy Cross, Rosicrucian, a lot of things with the secret society surrounded, and we remember how that money after 9/11 disappeared, all the contributions to the Red Cross. There was a big scandal. So the idea in this article was that the Ebola got started through vaccines given by the Red Cross. And we can't corroborate that, but we could present that as a theory so that, you see, we're never going to know whether everything that we say is backed up by full truth. Nobody is going to have all the answers. Not Dr. Stan Monteith, our late friend who did so much investigative work, not Alex Jones, not Rick Wiles, not Elizabeth and Lou Caverly. Nobody is going to have all the answers. But you know, there is one, and that is Almighty God. He knows, He sees, and He blesses, and He has mercy. So do get your heart right. So anyway, Nancy says that when this crisis deepened, sometimes a taxi would pull up and they'd open the door to find that a passenger had just died. And they opened up a part in their, I think in their chapel, where they began to put a lot of people. And so she came home really exhausted day after day, and she felt pretty safe because she wasn't directly working with the doctors and nurses touching, but she knew Kent Brantley. She knew him, Dr. Brantley, the other one who got the Ebola. And so finally, one day, July 22nd, her 59th birthday, she felt very tired. And she called her friend Debbie, one of the doctors, and she thought she had malaria. They ran a test, and yes, the blood smear was positive, so she went home to rest and took malaria medication. But 4 days later, Debbie did another malaria test, and it was negative. And now I'm going into her article, but I still had a high fever. Just to put everyone's mind at ease, she tested me for Ebola. David was at a meeting with some of the doctors when the results came back. And it's taken a little time to turn the page. In that night, he ran straight home and said, "I have some things I need to tell you. Dr. Brantley has Ebola, and Nancy, you do too." He reached out to comfort me, and I pulled back, saying, "No, don't." I didn't want David to get it, and I knew the reality. Ebola was potentially going to take my life, but I felt a sense of calm that I believe was God's presence and didn't shed any tears. Right then, I was most upset about everyone else. Dr. Brantley was more like a family member than a colleague. And David and I had lived together while I was sick, so I worried about his safety. Hardest days. And again, this is from Woman's Day, February 2015. Since I was already at home, they isolated me there, and David immediately began a 21-day monitoring isolation. He lived alone in an apartment, reported his temperature daily, and wasn't allowed within 3 feet of anyone. For days, he sat outside on the back porch of our house and talked to me through the window. I don't remember everything he said, but I always knew he was there and could feel his presence. The doctors and nurses came to treat me with fluids, electrolytes, and pain medications. I was also given 2 doses of ZMAP, an experimental Ebola drug. Each day, I got weaker and sicker. I was completely at the mercy of others, drifting in and out of consciousness. It felt like the worst flu you could ever imagine, and my skin was painful to the touch. Then, because of the fever and diarrhea, I started to dehydrate so badly that my veins didn't have enough volume, and Debbie couldn't get an IV into me. As she tried, she said, "No one should have to do this to her friend." That night, August 4th, after 10 days of isolation, I was evacuated back to the U.S. I didn't realize it at the time, but David had been working with Sims leadership and the U.S. government to get me out. They dressed me in PPE, and remember that was the short version for proper protective equipment, before they put my stretcher onto a plane. I said goodbye to David, thinking I might not ever see him again. He stayed in Liberia for 5 more days until he was able to travel, homeward bound. I was relieved to arrive at Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, where Dr. Brantley had been taken a few days earlier, but I knew that there was no guarantee I was going to live. I'd seen too much to be naive to the horrors of this virus. I just kept praying for strength. A team of 5 doctors and at least 21 nurses cared for me at Emory, and my sons, Jeremy, 36, and Brian, 34, visited. I saw them through a window from my bed and picked up the phone to hear their voices. They told me they loved me. With each passing day, I started to feel a tiny bit better, and after a week, one of the doctors walked in and said, "You've turned a corner." My lab work showed the viral load for Ebola was going down, which is a positive sign. When I heard that, I thought, I just might make it, feeling hopeful. As soon as David was in the clear, he visited me. When I saw him on August 17th, it had been almost 2 weeks since I'd laid eyes on my husband. I was strong enough to stand, so we put up our hands to meet on opposite sides of the window and just smiled. I'll never forget the feeling of looking him in the face again after so much uncertainty. Finally, after 14 days, I was told I could go home. I had survived Ebola. As I left my room, the doctors and nurses lined the hallway and cheered. Every single person either hugged me or shook my hand. When I stepped outside into the fresh air and sunshine, I felt a wave of gratitude. I could only say, "To God be the glory," over and over. Dr. Brantley was released 2 days later. Now people ask me, "What saved you? Was it the drug? Was it the care? Was it your faith?" My response, all of the above. I believe God used those doctors. He used the ZMAP, and he used my illness to make Americans aware of the suffering in West Africa. Before, it seemed like a faraway problem. It's really not, and I'm grateful that my situation helped shine a light on it. Today, I have an even greater passion for service, and my respect for the physicians and nurses who risk their lives has increased exponentially. As human beings, we need to do what we can, even in small ways, to love our fellow man and to relieve suffering. That's what Jesus did and what I'll strive to do wherever God calls us to go next. Nancy's husband, David, has a short tribute to her entitled, "She is the Most Beautiful Woman I Know."
While Nancy was in isolation in Liberia, I sat on our house's back porch and talked to her through an open window. I couldn't touch or hug my own wife, which is how I usually show affection. I had to keep her going only through words, which was a challenge for me. I tried to be as specific and as loving as possible, telling her that she is the most beautiful woman I know, and that I love her with all of my heart. Over the years, she has made me a better man, and now that she's cured, I want to express my gratitude and love for her in as many ways as I can for all the days that we're together. My goal is to love her in such a way that she knows that every day, She is the best part of my life, and my greatest joy is that I get to hang out with her.
Now, in juxtaposition to that, we had former Vice President Cheney saying, "I'd do it again in a minute," that referred to all the waterboarding and all the torture. Are we heading down a Nazi-like path? We can all see that through every presidency, the same kind of thing, starting back a long time, even before the Clintonian years, with MKUltra and all of those secret things done by the CIA and others, that it has been building. But 9/11 was a turning point, because there we got the Patriot Act, and now we have Obama's new directive with, you know, the National Defense Authorization Act, I believe, of 2011. So everything is stepping up to where Americans could be detained. So I think it's very important to hear what Al Cuppet saw, because this thing on the subway, is it an experimental test, seeing what it'll be like to kill a bunch of people right there? Just briefly, what did the Nazis do with the Einsatzgruppen?
what they did is they simply had these several thousand thugs disguised as soldiers follow the main army, the German army, as they invaded Russia and other countries, and just started killing everyone they could get their hands on, particularly the Soviet commissars and, of course, Jews, but also gypsies and other minorities, Slavs, that they considered subhuman.
Now, did they have any, let's say, transportation? You know, we've heard about the Chinese, the communist Chinese regime, having mobile vans, killing vans. Did they have anything like that where they could gas them in the vehicles?
Absolutely, yes. At first they tried just shooting, but that was so inefficient, they quickly decided to use gas. And they had vans that would use carbon monoxide in the early days, and then later it became more common to use other chemicals, as they did at the big concentration camps.
Now, this is widely documented, is it not, by reputable historians?
Oh, yes. This is came out at Nuremberg soon after the war. If time permits, I'll read a few things about that today. And it was known to the American and Red Armies as they marched into Germany in the closing years of the war. It was known among Jews, but not just Jews, many Christians, many other nationalities, Poles. This was a massive operation, and of course the citizens of the surrounding territory knew all about these things.
And here we have Reynaldo Hernandez on Monday, January 12th, holding a cloth over his face as he coughs deeply after he was evacuated from this smoke-filled metro subway tunnel. And what did kill that woman? They said that it was a foul-smelling smoke. Is this a Nazi experimental preparation? Let's find out about what Al Kopitz's testimony was of waking up to certain things. Lou, from America Sold Out.
Alexander B. Al Kopitz, committed Christian, former action officer, and command and control and intelligence communications inspector for the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Department of Defense, with 31 years of federal service in the military, 9 with the Department of Defense, including 2 years with the Air Staff. He holds the Bronze Star, the Purple Heart, the Defense Meritorious Service Award Medal, 3 awards of the Joint Service Medal, all of the Vietnamese awards, as well as the Joint Meritorious Unit Defense Meritorious Service Medals. Al revealed disturbing information about New World Order efforts to destroy and enslave America. When he retired a few years ago, he was awarded the Secretary of Defense Civilian Service Medal. He has been around the world to 31 countries on 4 continents and speaks 5 languages. He tells of the coming American Holocaust and the shadow government's plans for dealing with the so-called enemy combatants, Christians and Jews. He spoke of the infrastructure currently in place, which facilitates incarceration and eventual execution of quote-unquote listed Americans. He disclosed the locations of the facilities to be utilized for these purposes, including photographs. And he says, quote, the infrastructure is set up, unquote. There are at least 142 major funded concentration camps, including quietly modified facilities which have sprung up and continue to spring up across the country, seemingly devoid of activity, yet requiring abnormal accoutrements, such as barbed wire-topped fencing with the tops turned inward, and helicopter windsocks. Most have good logistical supportability, with major highways and railroad transport facilities adjacent to the sites. Goes on to say, these facilities, many in remote areas across the USA, are set up to become concentration detention camps, complete with gas chambers for resistors and dissidents. They are set up for dissidents who will not go along with the New World Order. The resistors are gun owners who refuse to give up their weapons. The dissidents are Christians, patriots, and constitutionalists, and surely theocratic Jews. These camps are real, and I personally have seen several. One is a crematorium. On August 6, 1994, I toured the Amtrak rail car repair facility at Beech Grove, Indianapolis, Indiana. There are at least 10 maintenance barns at this facility covering 129 acres, with two separate fences with the tops leaning inward. The windows of several buildings have been bricked up. Hence, you have three levels of security for Amtrak repair barns. There are three helicopter 25-knot aviation windsocks, which are not the correct ones to use for chemical spills, which require 10-knot windsocks. I have the address for These are high-security NSA-style people turnstiles and high-intensity security lighting for a 24-hour operation. The boxcar, gas chamber building fence, is marked with special red-blue zone signs. This corresponds to the mission of the red-blue lists, which surfaced in June and July of 1996. Under martial law, this will become a death camp. They are only going to handle Category 1 and 2, the red and blue people there. This boxcar facility will be used for execution. Quote, one of the barns is large enough to put four boxcars into. There are powered vents on the top of the barn to vent the gas out of the building after the boxcars have been fumigated. All of the buildings have newly installed 6-inch gas pipes and furnaces installed in all railroad barns. Since August 1994, FEMA has allocated $5.9 million to modify the walls and roofs of the buildings. Under martial law, this facility could be utilized as an SS-style termination gas chamber. On January 27, 1995, the Indianapolis News ran an article entitled, Amtrak Lays Off 212 at Beech Grove. 170 lose jobs at Maintenance Center today. Why perform $6 million worth of renovations and then lay off 212 people? Because the people doing the final executions will not be Americans. Thus, the slots of the 212 will eventually be filled with non-Americans. They will hire foreigners for this capo task. Capo, chief in Italian, was the title of the trustee prisoners who actually killed many Jews for the SS butchers at Dachau and at other Nazi crematoria across Europe. The news article also said, hopes the yard may be able to solicit work repairing private train cars and perhaps subway cars from Washington, D.C., or other urban areas. The repairing of private trains is a dead giveaway to death cars. The article went on to say, late last year, Congress ordered Amtrak to spend at least $5.9 million patching holes in the roof and fixing masonry in the walls of the giant machine sheds at Beech Grove. These buildings have been sealed. They are suitable, they are suitable or airtight. The facility is constructed to allow gas to be blown into all the buildings via the newly installed two-story hot air blower heating furnaces. The red list is for pickup and execution before unobtrusive preparations for martial law is initiated. The blue list is also for execution, but later, within 6 weeks of martial law declaration. There are no re-education plans for either category, just execution. When you get picked up in a red pickup, they'll take you from your home at night, probably around 4 a.m., and put you in a black van, then drive you to a helicopter waiting to fly you to an intermediate point. There, you will be loaded into a big 64-passenger CH-47 Chinook helicopter, all black, unmarked and illegally operating under the, quote-unquote, treaty and open skies. Then they'll fly you to one of the 38 cities where you'll board a 747, 737, or 727 aircraft. You may be taken straight to a temporary detention facility. When you are red-listed, you will be taken to a red camp. Then you'll be executed. At some point, martial law will be declared. Martial law is the writ of habeas corpus to have a trial by jury. I believe that's a misprint there. Martial law is when the writ of habeas corpus to have a trial by jury is suspended. Instead of going to the judge, you go straight to jail for a limited time. A suspect suspect there will be a major outrage or some other crisis, there will be a major outrage or some other crisis, which will be the reason to declare martial law. At this point, the blue-listed people will be picked up. At that time, the country will be regionalized into 10 regions, which are already designated by FEMA. Be advised that it has been proven in Wyoming and at least one other location that the black choppers have state-of-the-art radio frequency RF wideband jammers and can jam cell phones and CBs while they're executing black operations missions. This means that your cell phone could be jammed just before and or during any action against you. You recall during 9/11, virtually every cell phone in America, but especially on the entire East Coast, was rendered inoperable. And the editor's note, Al Cuppett being the editor, a continuous rod warhead missile fired from a chopper employing a spoofer transponder to spoof the terminal radar at JFK facilitated the shoot-down of TWA Flight 800. The chopper was flown by a foreign pilot. In June of 1996, an FBI agent got hold of the Region 3 Blue List from a CIA agent and found his own name on it and those of several others he knew in Virginia. The Regional Blue List stated that the names on the Blue List would be picked up within 6 weeks of the actual martial law declaration. This parallels the Nazi Red Blue List policy almost to the letter. Heinz Hohn published the parallel Nazi plan in his 1966 book, The Story of the Nazi SS, The Order of the Death's Head. People say it won't work. Nevertheless, it will work if the several million covert Soviet troops currently here can get the confiscated guns. The name of the game is to blackball the people to get the guns. Make the militias look bad. Make guns look bad. Make everybody give up their guns. Once they get your guns, they have you, unless you have the angel of the Lord at your door. If you've got the angel of the Lord out there protecting you, it's another story. The ones doing all of this are operating out of the highest places in the federal government. By that, I mean the post-9/11 identified shadow government. They are cooperating with spirit guides and mediums and using astrology and numerology. Hillary Clinton was openly doing this, and a former Secret Service agent revealed to me the debauchery going on in the White House by many. The spirit guides are telling them what to do, and the entire thing is being orchestrated at the highest spiritual levels of Illuminism, Satanism, and the occult skull and bones. Every base has been covered. They have thought of everything, note, except the eternal God factor. P.S., if you notice, they often do things on the 13th of the month. Alternatively, on full moons or other satanic holidays. Who will be doing the actual picking up? Foreign cops, United Nations Internal Security Forces. Over 30 foreign military bases under the U.N. flag are already set up in the U.S., all with the approval of special shadow government appointees in high federal positions. These bases are already manned with over 2 million troops from Russia, Poland, Germany, Belgium, Turkey, Great Britain, Nicaragua, and Asian countries. Why are they here? And the 2 million includes those in Canada and Mexico as well. Because unlike our own troops, many of which along with the Guard and Reserve of 24 states are being deployed overseas, they will have no qualms about firing on U.S. citizens when the time comes. There are more than 2,000 Russian tanks, military transport trucks, and chemical warfare vehicles just outside Gulfport, Mississippi. They began arriving in January of 1994. There are 180 foreign troops at Fort Riley, which was confirmed to me by a brigadier general. 300 came into the Birmingham, Alabama airport on a big white Russian cargo plane on December 13, 1995. As of 1995, there were 10,000 foreign troops at Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, reportedly making preparations for 20,000, quote-unquote, detainees. This is going on all over the country. I know a soldier who was in Special Forces, also known as Delta Force, although he revealed no records. He confirmed that these suggestions by Mr. Coppard are possible. German troops are known to be at Holloman Air Base in New Mexico, Fort Bliss, and Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, Dulles Airport outside Washington, and Fort Hood, Texas. Chinese troops are known to be at the Long Beach Naval Station in California. There is not going to be some future event when the invading troops are going to show up. They are already here. When martial law is implemented, these foreign UN troops will be policing our country, carrying out the plans of the New World Order. And a note from Al Coppard, an editor's note, there is, was a German Armed Forces Bundeswehr headquarters base at Reston, Virginia. The CIA shadow government operatives do censor the major news media and make certain that the news that you digest is carefully controlled. I thought that it was interesting that some of the people or patriots that I talked to afterwards said, I've heard all of this before. So have I. But none had ever connected it for me quite as well before. Our Constitution is gone. There is no more balance of power since the president and presidents for many years now rule by executive order, a de facto dictatorship. Furthermore, the Congress failed to rid themselves of Clinton because Hillary had everyone's FBI files and knew all the dirty laundry. If you saw the credit and FBI reports of a number of your congressional representatives, you would say, we're in trouble. The New World Order is in place and has been for several years.
Very, very hard-hitting things to think about. Very much so. And now, as a little postscript to the information from Al Coppard that Lou presented, he says that in another memo, and this was July 2001, an update, he says on August the 6th, 1994, at 15:55 hours, I arrived at Amtrak's Beech Grove Repair Facility in Indianapolis on the only day of the month which was designated as open house, then, quote, open, to show the public that Linda Thompson's video, America Under Siege, was just misguided paranoia. That is, the place isn't a, quote, final solution termination camp. No. Then why was it completely sanitized after Thompson's 1993 video and my 1998 video? Why were the fences changed, the red-blue zone signs, etc., taken down after spending $5.9 million, quote, renovating the 90-year-old place into such a configuration? And I've heard Al Coppard, I'm interjecting here, Elizabeth Coppard Caverly, say that Linda Thompson was taken out. And, of course, he stands by this story. He was an eyewitness to this place. I've heard Alex Jones refute this. So, you know, you have to be wise as serpents and gentle as doves. You have to listen and listen and listen. And you still may not know who's who. Who's COINTELPRO? Who isn't? Now, personally, I think Alex Jones is one of the more credible people. Frankly, I do. I might not agree with him spiritually. I hate his heavy metal rock music. I don't think that really is what God wants for his program either. But I admire his courage, and I admire that he does mention Jesus Christ. And I admire that he will not quit in trying to preserve liberty for his family, for his children, for others. These are really noble attributes. We can't have everything in one person. Then we can go to someone like Rick Wiles, and we can see, again, a very confident commentator and someone who at times, at his best, has wonderful programs. I listened last night, and I heard Diana West, who has stopped her syndicated newspaper column. I hope that wasn't under duress, because she is the one who brought out about the government stockpiling the bullets, 1.6 billion rounds of hollow point ammunition in March of 2013. And she has a powerful book, which we haven't had time to read yet, America's Betrayal, but we learned that it's now in paperback. So there was a wonderful interview with her about Islam and the real truth there. And then there was another powerful interview with a scientist from MIT, And she stated that she does believe that vaccines help to play a role, a strong role in autism, but also the glyphosate used in Roundup Ready and all of that business from Monsanto. And it was just a terrible, terrible thing to hear her say that she thinks by about the year 2032, it'll be half of the children in America with autism. Yes, our program must mean something. We must warn people, if you don't tell anybody about the New World Order, please start telling your friends, your relatives about the vaccinations. Usually little children are normal till about the age of almost two. They're talking and they're playing and they're laughing, and then suddenly they regress because they've had that MMR shot. Please, please pray about what the Lord wants you to do. Well, now back to what Al says about this refurbishing, this strange refurbishing of the place when he was there. This is a little more information. The Amtrak guard, J.D., who had a NATO-style black uniform in waiting in his locker, escorted me through the complex. I saw the aviation 25-knot windsocks. Trains don't fly. Bricked-up windows. New gas heating furnaces with 6-inch gas pipes, NSA-style high-security turnstiles, a 2-tier barbed wire fence system with inward-leaning tops, which with the building door locks made it a triple security facility for rail cars and more. The more was the last building we observed, at which the guard told me, "This is the one building that's equipped for holding rail cars. You can put 4 boxcars in there at a time." My later notice, strictly by chance, photo reveals powered air vents in the roof of that, quote, boxcar building. Now, this is really something, I think. And how did we find out? Purely accidentally. There are no coincidences or accidents in God's plan. Lou went online back in about the year 2001, maybe in the spring, to find out more about chemtrails. Because he had this magazine that I read, he didn't have time to read it, and it was one of these silly magazines, UFO magazine, but it had Will Thomas with a very thoughtful article about were there chemtrails, that contrails should dissolve in the atmosphere within minutes, but what were these long-lasting things, this new phenomenon? So when Lou went online to find chemtrails, lo and behold, he found Al Cuppett's letter to General John Jumper and other military officials about the Treaty on Open Skies, how we're just allowed to have all this. If the treaty was signed, we can have foreign flights. They can be doing anything they want, although we think that it's our own military doing this pretty much with these chemtrails. So at any rate, when Lou found this, of course, my maiden name being Cuppett, he came home and said, "I found your relative, Al Cuppett." I said, "Well, gee, I wonder who he is." And he said he's connected with some kind of a right-wing organization called the Prophecy Club. We began ordering videos. And, of course, we got Colonel Jim Ammerman's interview on his video about the imminent takeover of the United States. And what a noble person that is, too. I think the New World Order tried to eliminate him, but he was not eliminated. He was the head chaplain of the army. What a wonderful witness for Christ. And you see, Lou and I began to have our eyes opened. We were just in shock after watching that, weren't we, Lou?
Yes, that was quite a revelation. I guess the word shock is about the only word you can use for it.
But you see, God has held these events back because that was 1995-96 that Ammerman's video came out. Look where we are now. We've had, it'll be 14 years since 9/11. God has been merciful. He's holding back the judgment. And I personally believe that some of it is because of some of the prayers of some of you listening to this program. You might not have any money, but you know, God hasn't let this program die. No. Even someone who...